My name is Dr. Ethel Tungohun. I'm a writer, a researcher, an activist, and an associate professor of politics. This is Academic Aunties. A few days ago, we celebrated International Women's Day. Every year on March 8, which is when I'm recording this intro, we shine a spotlight on the continuing realities of gender-based discrimination and gender-based violence worldwide. Through the ceaseless and untiring work of feminist activists, I'd like to think that we now have common frames of reference when understanding the pervasiveness of violence against women. The Me Too movement, for example, has sparked recognition about the ways that so many women, particularly trans, indigenous, black, and racialized women, have had to live with this violence. And this violence is not individual, but is part of the very structures and institutions that make up society, including academia. So I'm so glad to have Dr. Mandy Gray with us on today's episode. She has just released a new book, Suing for Silence, Sexual Violence and Defamation Law, which impacts the ways that systems of power, specifically the criminal legal system that is, quote, comprised of patriarchal and colonial laws, end quote, protect the privileged. In our conversation, we explore the ways that abusive men and abusive institutions punish women for speaking up about their experiences of abuse, and how they also punish women for providing support to women who have experienced sexual abuse. This includes campus sexual violence and the repercussions faced by students and faculty members who break the silence. It's an important and timely conversation. And just a note, keep listening to the end of this interview to learn about how you can enter a draw to win a free copy of Mandy's book. Have a listen. It is an immense honor for us to have Dr. Mandy Gray with us today to talk about her fantastic new book, Suing for Silence, Sexual Violence and Defamation Law. Mandy is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Trent University and an anti-violence activist. And I'm so happy that you were able to share space with us today. How are you doing, Mandy?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be on your show. And I've been really looking forward to our conversation.
That's great. And one thing I will say, I read this book and I read it over 2 days. It's such an important contribution. It wasn't an easy book to read. There were parts, to be honest, where, especially when delving into chapter 4 on campus sexual violence, that I was like, hey, stop, let's take a drink of water, and then let's continue. But, you know, I just want to congratulate you and say this, I think, is going to be a game changer. I've talked to so many people about this book, just in conversation, just telling them, just read it. It's really, it's important. It's not an easy read, but it's an important read. And so Suing for Silence is about the individual and societal consequences of defamation lawsuits that men who were accused of sexual violence file against silence breakers. Mandy, who are these silence breakers?
Yeah, I really wanted to stress in the writing of the book was that the people who were being sued were not just the people who had directly experienced the sexual violence. Of course, I talked to a number of people who had been sued for disclosing or reporting sexual violence, but many of the people I spoke to were not necessarily the people who had been directly harmed. And I think that's like a very deliberate strategy of, and it is predominantly men who have been the people who initiated these lawsuits. So I felt that the term silence breaker better encompass the diversity of people who are being sued for defamation, and also spoke to what they were doing in breaking the silence around sexual violence. And so I felt that was a pretty apt term to use to better encompass the different roles of people involved. And it wasn't just the people who were directly harmed by the sexual violence.
I thought that was eye-opening because my impression prior to reading this book was that silence breakers were predominantly the ones who were suing men, right? Like immediately, and your book makes references to this, Amber Heard would be someone who people would automatically associate with being a silence breaker. So I thought it was galling to see that bystanders, people who provide support, people who tweet support, people who don't know the silence breaker who directly is implicated in the lawsuit, that they're also encompassed as part of this group of silence breakers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, some of the surprising ones were like Senator Mary Lou McFedrin, who wasn't a senator at the time, for example, writing an op-ed, another journalist who had written about the very systematic abuse of Indigenous children and was then sued by the alleged perpetrator. So yeah, it went far beyond the people who had been directly harmed. And I think also to stress to that point as well, it was not always the person accused of the sexual violence initiating the legal action. So for example, in the case of Senator Mary Lou McFedrin, it was the Ontario Medical Association, yes, who tried to shut her down. And in the chapter on campus, it was a university president, for example. So I think while it was predominantly the men who had been accused of sexual violence, the plaintiff or the person threatening legal action was also sometimes a bigger power or authority than the individual being accused.
I think one thing this book, well, the book does excellent things throughout, but another chapter that was extremely illuminating to me was your gendered analysis of how legal concepts that we take for granted have gendered implications. So for example, even this emphasis on reputation, reputational harm, at face value, we think, well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's something we should all be concerned about. But the way you kind of deconstruct how that's so gendered, especially as they're used in defamation lawsuits, was so eye-opening, truly.
Yeah, and I think that's what was really interesting to me about this work, because we think of defamation as being this very niche area of law, but when you really look at it, defamation is so sociological, and the concept of reputation is totally determined by our social world and what we place emphasis on. And just the mere fact that the defamation was created so men relied less on like bloody duels and the encouragement of civil society. So I found the research around reputation far more fascinating than I really gave the concept credit for, and the differentiation what men will sue for versus what women historically sued for, and was that was like, you know, whether it impacted their ability to marry was of primary concern, whereas for men it was more in alignment with their property or you know, other ability to make money in a capitalist society. So I did find that quite fascinating as well.
Absolutely. Let's hone in on another concept that you spell out in the book. What is DARVO?
Yes, DARVO was initially coined by psychologist Jennifer Freid, and it refers to deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender. And I think what I found so compelling about Freid's argument was that, of course, men who are wrongfully accused defend their reputation and will take steps to restore their reputation, but it's men who are abusive who, and this is what something I found among many of the people I spoke to, was that these men used multiple institutional complaint mechanisms, yes, to really torment many of these silence breakers. Several women had the police show up at their door and be accused of online harassment. And then there was a defamation lawsuit. And then they were suddenly had a human rights complaint against them at their workplace. And so what happens when all these processes are initiated is that the man, or typically I say, because statistically it was men who were initiating all these complaint processes, became the true victims of reputational damage, which in turn obscured the sexual violence or gendered violence that had occurred, and really becomes about him and the costs to him and his family and his reputation at work or ability to continue in their workplace or position. And that really becomes the central focus. And then the gendered violence becomes of secondary importance.
Yeah, it's not important anymore.
Exactly. And so I do think it is really critical that there is that acknowledgement that, yeah, of course, some people will defend their reputation, but it's when all of these complaint processes and other forms of harassment get ignited and really obscure what the initial complaint was about, and that being gendered violence.
100%. Can you talk us through one of the cases that you discuss in the book that stood out to you as being a particularly stark example of how these lawsuits can be an abusive control tactic by men accused of sexual violence?
One of the cases that really, really stuck out to me was of Catherine, who was a young woman of color in her early 20s and experienced multiple forms of gendered violence. And when she went to the police, they basically dismissed her. Mm-hmm. And then other women came forward and he entered into a peace bond, which is the equivalent of a restraining order. It's not an admission of guilt, but something happened. There is now this legal restraining order type thing in place. And so Catherine posted on social media that that had happened to her too. And, you know, to validate that and essentially keep other people safe. It was a small community. And not only did he respond by reporting her to the police, had the police show up at her door. And so they didn't investigate her complaint of gendered violence, but had no problem investigating her for harassment. And then not only was there the police involved, he then initiated legal action.
Oh my God.
Knowing full well that there was, you know, she's a young woman of color very early on in her career. Her family wasn't supportive and really had very little recourse. And it was just by total fluke that she went to a legal clinic, and the volunteer lawyer that day was just like horrified by this case and agreed to represent her pro bono. And they eventually came to a agreement, but the impact was so detrimental to her well-being. And I would say that I think two or three of other women that I interviewed for this project also shared that they had been investigated by the police, and the impact on them when they attempted. And I think this is another misconception in the research, is that folks often assume that I'm talking about social media allegations primarily. And while several of the people did make posts on social media, very rarely was that their first stop.
Yeah.
Many of them only went to social media when every other avenue was closed, whether it was attempting to report to the police and then they don't investigate, they don't follow through, they're not pressing charges, or they report to their workplace and the workplace does nothing, or the investigation's taking years to conclude. So I think that it's also important to dispel that assumption that these lawsuits are only happening in response to social media posts. And even when it is about social media, it's the last possible avenue. So I think that's important to take into consideration as well when thinking through, like, that people are trying to make formal reports, or they are making formal reports and they're not protected.
Yeah, for sure. And I want us to talk a little bit, if that's okay, about chapter 4, about universities and what happens when there is campus sexual violence. And given that this is academic antis, I do want to focus a little bit on this. So Mandy, what happens generally when universities receive a complaint of sexual violence against one of its members? Knowing, of course, that different universities have different governance practices, but I just want our listeners to listen to you as you walk us through what generally happens.
Yeah, and I do think that I can only speak to the Canadian context, of course, but I think within the last decade, there have been improvements in terms of, like, there is now legislation that requires universities in most provinces that receive public funding to have a mechanism for reporting. It's not perfect. And I think I also need to stress, reporting sexual violence and going through an investigation or formal reporting process will never be good. It's always going to be traumatic to varying degrees. I think that it'll never be something that people are going to look forward to doing. So I'm not going to comment on whether it's better or a good experience for people, because I think given the context, it will always be a difficult one. However, within the last decade, when with this new legislation, a lot of universities have invested in having actual policies that, and I mean, the thing with the policies, though, is they're often overly legal. They're very complicated. There's a lot of gray area of uncertainty about what's going to happen. But I will say, in this regard, maybe it is a little bit better. There is now an investigative model. There's, of course, flaws with that. Depending on who's involved, their investigator might be in-house, so someone employed by the university. In some circumstances, especially if it's a faculty that's being accused, typically the investigator will be a lawyer from a third-party law firm. And typically, in terms of sometimes they'll be the decision makers in terms of whether or not it happens. Sometimes it'll be within the university itself deciding on a balance of probabilities. And then where it gets really sticky, though, is consequences. And that's typically where I've seen a lot of disappointment in terms of what the remedy is recommended. And the remedy is often disappointing. But I have, like I said, there's several cases I've talked about in the book where faculty have lost their jobs as a result. So I don't think it would be fair to say that nothing ever happens, because we have instances where these measures have taken place, where the faculty have lost their jobs. That's kind of a very high level and general summary. But like you were saying before, it really depends institution to institution. And the other complicating factor is who the accused is. So for example, if it's a student, that process will look quite differently than if it's a faculty, because the faculty has all these protections through the union, as well as many of the different staff people on campus as well.
For sure. And I think, and I know this is what happens, but seeing it on page was so saddening, right? That universities tend to do a risk assessment when assessing these claims. Can you explain what this risk assessment entails? I mean, I know you already talked about how it depends on the actors involved. If it's a student filing against a faculty member, the faculty member is unionized and has a lot of protections. But like, what do universities generally factor in when they conduct this risk assessment?
I do think with more public pressure, it has shifted in the last several years. But when I first started doing this work in 2015, the risk assessment was often, who's more likely to sue us? And for a long time, it would have been, and we'll say statistically, the man, whether it's a student or faculty. And so, you know, but I do think that analysis has shifted slightly as more people who have experienced sexual violence have also started taking legal action against the university. Like, I do think that kind of pressure has helped a bit. And I mean, just about, I'd say about like 3 or 4 months ago, there was quite a big decision at the BC Human Rights Tribunal of the case of Stephanie Hale, who got a pretty substantial public judgment at the Human Rights Tribunal that the university didn't do enough. She also got fairly decent financial compensation from UBC Okanagan as well. And so I do think that analysis might be shifting, but we also need to take into consideration like non-legal assessments that takes in like reputation. It doesn't just exist for these men. Reputation and reputational management is also a massive consideration for universities that have in as a result of neoliberalism, have really taken on this branding and how they want to be perceived, which can sometimes work to our advantage. They don't want to be on the front page of the Globe and Mail or Toronto Star, but also doing nothing or stalling or taking a really long time to resolve complaints, especially when you were talking about undergraduate students where there is a high turnover. And yeah, I really feel for the undergraduate students who really have the least amount of protection in these in the campus space specifically.
I think based on how long I've been a professor and how long I've been in academia, I have witnessed the changes that you're talking about, and some of these developments are positive. And so, you know, we don't want to kind of make it seem as though universities aren't like shifting practices, right? But I don't know. I mean, one of the overriding themes of the podcast is that institutions can never love us back, right? And how it's so challenging operating within these systems where you oftentimes feel gaslit. So One thing that struck me when reading the chapter on campus sexual violence was how you talked about institutional co-optation of feminist language like intersectionality and making it appear as though they now have this like feminist mindset. And yet there are still structures that make it hard, for example, for students to come out or for accountability measures to really be embedded, right? We all know that when some of these cases are filed against, say, faculty members, they're resolved individually. And so faculty members get a chance to leave quietly. They get hired by a new institution that doesn't know what's happening, right? And so, you know, the same patterns of sexual violence happen again. So I guess, Mandy, my question is, can you explain the discrepancy between feminist words and actions and decidedly anti-feminist tactics that take place?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that most campus sexual assault policies I have seen have the, and I think Emily Colpitt's term of like ornamental intersectionality that she uses in her paper, a lot of them reference and use these like feminist language to describe the policies. But in practice, and I think Sarah Ahmed's work is really good at showing like what they say and what they're what actually happens. I often think to her work and Living a Feminist Life and her book Complaint in terms of the discrepancy that happens there. And that's, it's been very interesting because at the same time, a lot of these campuses across Canada, again, hired really awesome critical feminists from the grassroots movement into these offices, and many of them are doing incredible work. But I think it's also been quite frustrating for them to have institutions that are not always necessarily open to new ways of thinking or doing things. They'll use the language on their website, or like they get these positions and they're just totally under-resourced and can't necessarily keep up with the sheer volume of needs of the students or the cost savings measures of wanting to cut corners and not always provide the best quality of resources that the people often need. And so I think that there's a lot of problems, and I think it really is rooted in like this neoliberalization of the university more generally. And I think another interesting facet to all this work is just the focus so much on universities and really an exclusion of colleges. We often don't really include colleges when we talk about campus sexual assaults, but those students are also experiencing sexual and gendered violence with really detrimental long-term impacts on their careers, on their studies. I spoke to a number of students who either failed out of their courses or, you know, like there's big consequences as a result of ongoing gendered violence.
Absolutely. One other thing that I kind of noted in chapter four was, even as institutions are improving and even as institutions have built in mechanisms to ensure that some accountability measures have taken place, some of the repercussions are actually like social, right? And so you talk about the cases of Gina, Charlene, and Julie and how they actually, you know, suffered for being supportive of silence breakers. Can you talk a little bit generally about how bystanders within universities get caught up?
Absolutely. And I think this really speaks to one element that was really chilling to me, was that these are women that are like top of their game, like very high up in the hierarchy of academia, well established. Charlene, I believe, is a full professor. Julie McFarlane as well, and she has given permission to use her name, and is a very prolific legal scholar. And so to see these women in such high regard in the university, and then when they stood up to the inequities and injustices that they saw these students facing, experienced pretty severe reputational damage. For example, Gina being denied tenure despite having published multiple books, for example, Charlene being removed from a colleague's tenure committee. These all are things that had very significant consequences professionally for these women. And yet we're still so fixated on the men and their reputational damage that they endured or through this process. And so I think for me, seeing just how quickly that institution can go from loving you to disposing of you. And Julie McFarlane did initiate legal action against her university and has since left her position as a professor. And I encourage folks to check out her website, Can't Buy My Silence, because now she's really done some really fantastic campaign work around the use of non-disclosure agreements across settings, but in campus settings specifically. She's been working with one of the silence breakers from the Harvey Weinstein case, and they've been doing a lot of really important work to ban the use of non-disclosure agreements in instances of sexual violence as a means to ensuring that people are safe and they can't jump from institution to institution, like you were saying previously. But I will say, I will leave on a little hopeful note on that matter, because I did find it very inspiring that I asked all of these people in positions of power who were silence breakers if they would do it again. And all of them said they would. And not only did they say they would do it again, they would do it smarter and they would have gone harder. Like, so that gave me some hope that despite all of the brutality, their experience of supporting a survivor, of supporting someone who was reporting and going through this institutional process, the consequences they faced were not enough to stop them from doing it again. And so I found that very inspiring as well, to hear them, that it didn't silence them entirely.
I think that was really clear as well, the way you write it, like even as they narrated all of these harrowing, you know, emotionally and psychologically distressing accounts, everyone said, no, as you said, I'm going to go harder and I'm going to do it smarter. And I think this is why this book is such an important contribution, because it alerts us of the pitfalls of some of the legal actions in front of us. It was truly quite an experience reading this book, because things I thought I knew, I didn't know, you know? And so I do want to thank you again for writing this book and for sharing space with us. I guess my final question is, you know, you end this book by talking about suggestions for legal remedies, right? But you also end by saying, legal remedies aren't enough, right? And then you say that systemic organizing is actually crucial. What do you mean by that? Why is it important to focus on systemic organizing?
I don't know. I feel such an inherent contradiction that I think a lot of activist scholars probably often face of the push-pull of legal reform. I think specifically in the space of feminist legal organizing, I look at the labor that went into changing the criminal legal system. And I mean, Canada has amongst the most progressive sexual assault laws in the world, like a leader. And what has that actually done for people who've experienced sexual violence? The rates of sexual violence have remained stable. We're not seeing an increase of people willing to report. We're not seeing more convictions, for example. But I do think symbolically, those laws and what the law says are very nice and are reflective of feminist thought and labor. But I worry that going down the same path in the civil legal system, will that actually materially benefit people who've experienced gendered violence or have supported people who have experienced gendered violence? At the end of the book, there was, I think, what I intended for was a call to action of people in positions of power and privilege to continue talking. And I say this as somebody who myself, I am in a very lengthy 6-year defamation lawsuit, but it's not the end of me. It's something that I can survive. And I know that a lot of my peers can also weather. And so I don't want to make it sound like I'm saying, be quiet and stop talking about this. I'm actually hoping the opposite of know what you're up against, but don't stop talking for those of us who have the privilege to do so. And I think that's really critical piece. The whole relying solely on the legal reform. I'm just, even today I was talking to a lawyer who litigates a lot of these cases, and she just said to me, I just wish that we would stop using the legal system, especially the civil legal system, because it's so financially devastating. We have so few protections in the civil legal system, but it's the way it's set up is a very useful tool for silencing.
100%. Reading this book is a call to action for me personally. It has made me aware of what the stakes are. And I think readers of this book will actually feel empowered. You make clear that the lesson isn't for us to shut up, right? The lesson for us is to act, but act strategically and know what you're up against. And for that, Mandy, thank you so, so much. I mean, congratulations. This is, as I said, such an amazing book. And thank you for sharing space with us today. Suing for Silence is an excellent book. I learned a lot about the realities of the law and why legal remedies, while important, are limited. What I will be mulling over in the weeks ahead is how we can collectively organize to combat sexual violence. Organizing can help prompt the institutional and structural shifts necessary to engender support for silence breakers and to combat cultural codes that see violence against women and girls as being completely normal. I can't recommend this book enough, and we are giving a few copies of the book away. If you want a chance to win a free copy of Suing for Silence, retweet or repost this episode using hashtag Suing for Silence and tag Mandy at GodbySassPants on Twitter and Academic Auntie on Twitter or Academic Aunties on Blue Sky or Instagram. And that's Academic Aunties for this week. Contact us at podcast@academicaunties.com and follow us on social media at Academic Aunties. This podcast relies on community support. We don't rely on corporate funding, nor do we get any grants for this podcast. So please, if you like our podcast, consider becoming a Patreon supporter or buying swag from our online shop. You can check out our website for more information. Today's episode of Academic Aunties was produced by me, Wayne Chu, and Dr. Nisha Nath. Tune in next time as we talk to more Academic Aunties. Until then, take care, be kind to yourself, and don't be an asshole.